acceptance is not something that would apply to the majority of subdivisions. It would only apply if allowed by the locality. This would be an instance where a developer chooses to have reduced internal connectivity for the promise of future external connectivity, and if that promise never materialized when the neighboring parcels were developed, that network addition would be removed from the street system after 1 year. Now, as I said, these do not apply to the stub outs that are required for the external connectivity, and they would not apply for anyone who generally just meets the connectivity requirements as previously laid out. Moving on to page 18, are the administrative procedures of the regulation. These procedures, for the most part, are unchanged from existing practice. They require developers to submit a preliminary plan of development to VDOT for review. This preliminary plan contains the general layout of the development, including location of any transportation facilities. The department will review it for compliance with its requirements and standards, and approval from the department will allow the developer to move forward with the construction of such streets, knowing that they will be accepted by the department. The regulation also allows for the phased development of collector and other higher order streets when the development is serving is being phased. On page 23, the pedestrian accommodations section of the regulation, and this is another one of the mandatory requirements from the enabling legislation. In compact area types, streets would need to have sidewalks along both sides to meet the requirements. In suburban area types, the developer would have the option of either providing sidewalks along both sides of the street or using a system of trails and sidewalks. However, in areas located within the suburban area type where the lot sizes are 2 acres or greater, a developer could use what the rural requirements, which is a sidewalk along one side of the street or just a system of trails. In the rural area type,
Nick, a question as it relates to trails. The thing about sidewalks is they run along streets. So if the streets give you the level of connectivity that you're looking for, inevitably the sidewalks will, because they run along the streets. Once you go to a trail system, which really divorces that connection, you know, there's a tendency in a lot of these developments, the trails go places, but they're not useful in any way. So part of the whole purpose here, as I understand it, part of the dictate of the General Assembly is to have a level of pedestrian connectivity that's useful, as well as road connectivity. What in here guarantees that where a developer chooses to go to a trail system, that that trail system has the level of connectivity for pedestrians that they would have had they stayed with sidewalks?
That's a very good question, Mr. Schwartz, and you are right. One of the goals of this initiative is to provide direct pedestrian connectivity, and one of the things we've tried to avoid in this regulation is spelling out directly how someone is going to accomplish a goal, and so we have some language in here, and it would be at the district administrator designee or likely the residency administrator's discretion of whether or not those trails provide reasonably direct access, which is a requirement that's put into the regulation. And so that is going to be something that's going to be subjective, where the residency administrator is going to have to go out and look at the local terrain, the other extenuating circumstances that may exist, and determine whether or not what the developer is proposing to provide do meet the spirit of this regulation.
That may just be something to put on your list of things to think about a little bit more.
So noted.
Just to follow up, I just noticed there's not a definition of trails.
I believe
even though there is one for shared use path.
I believe it's multi-use trails is the definition.
From the multi-use trail.
And in the rural area type, the pedestrian accommodations could be satisfied by providing a sidewalk on one side of the street or a trail system throughout the development. However, on streets that have an annual daily traffic of 200 vehicles or less, the pedestrian accommodation requirements would be waived. And as I discussed at the last meeting, this is based on several analyses that were conducted by VDOT staff that showed the pedestrian quality of service in those instances would still be something that is acceptable nationwide. And your LOS runs from F to A, and so in those circumstances, the level of service C could still be achieved. And that's using a quality of service measure that the board has seen before. It is incorporated into the traffic impact analysis regulations.
Mr. Chairman, as I was telling Nick before the meeting, the presentation to the Region 2000 MPO was really well done and well attended by a number of political jurisdictions that are members of that NPO. The comment that I heard frequently following that meeting related to the rural area sidewalk and trail requirements and a concern that that wasn't needed. And I've passed that on to Nick, and I hope you'll keep that in mind. I would imagine you're hearing that from other parts of the state as well.
We will keep that in mind, and that is one of the changes that has been made since that briefing to today is this exemption for streets that have 200 vehicles a day per less. And I imagine in rural areas that may be a fair number of streets, as 200 vehicles a day, that leaves about 20 houses that would have to be located along that section of street. If you turn to page 27, you'll see the appeals provision of the regulation. Developer may appeal to the district administrator on unresolved differences of opinion between the residency administrator and the developer. The district administrator does have set time frames under which they must respond to the developer, and prior to receiving such response, the developer may request a meeting with the district administrator. Starting on page 28 and running to page 38 are other design and geometric requirements. For the most part, the provisions in this section of the regulation remain unchanged.
Excuse me. I thought I was asleep at the switch here, but every time you make a page reference, I find that the one I have in front of me is about two or three pages behind the one you're referencing. For example, what you just mentioned, geometric requirements, is at the top of page 25 on the one that I have. Do we have the latest iteration?
This may be an issue related to how track changes are showing up in the I have in-text deletions. You may have bubble deletions, and if that is the case, I do apologize. I was hoping that we'd all be operating.
Yeah, these have all the deletions and whatnot.
Are the deletions in text? That accounts for the difference. I do apologize. I sent this file to Carol this morning.
Okay. It's the same thing, just different pagination.
Yes, sir. And I do apologize for that confusion. I was not aware of that. In the future, I'll make sure that we avoid that.
Yeah, well, I'm glad it's you and not me.
At our age.
And what this section of the regulation does here is it spells out that streets constructed by developers and local governments must meet the geometric requirements and standards that the department has set out in the road design manual, the subdivision street design guide, and the pavement design guide. This is also the section that incorporates some provisions related to stormwater management that allows those facilities to be provided within the VDOT right-of-way as long as there is an agreement that absolves VDOT of any liability either due to failure of such system or for maintenance and inspection. This section also stipulates that the street width and the subdivision street design guide will vary based on whether or not the parking in such areas is anticipated to be on-street or off-street parking. It provides the residency administrator with the flexibility to establish reduced parking requirements for either individual developments or classes of developments. And it allows on-street parking on collector roadways with a speed limit of 35 miles an hour or less in urban areas. Curb and gutter continues to remain an optional street design element. There were some changes to the utility placement section. One of the changes was instead of placing utilities in the middle of the roadway, they'll now be in the middle of the travel lane. This will help resolve some of the issues you may have heard from local citizens where whenever utility work occurs, the entire roadway is closed down because the utility companies dig up the middle of the roadway, and now hopefully we'll only close one section of the roadway so that your citizens won't be, or your constituents won't be burdened. Moving on to page 39, the section related to sureties and fees. The surety requirements in the previous regulation was $2,000 per tenth of lane mile. That has been increased in this regulation to $3,000 per tenth of lane mile. That increase is based on the increase in highway construction cost based on the producer price index. The length of surety varies from 1 to 3 years and is based on the type of inspection process that was used. The administrative cost recovery fee has been raised from $2,500 per lane mile to $3,000 per lane mile. This increase is based on a study the Virginia Transportation Research Council conducted in 2006 and 2007, which looked at the cost the department incurred in its land development activities. The maintenance fee has been removed from the regulation with the increased surety requirements, and there's a new inspection fee per lane mile, which varies based on the type of inspection process that was used, from either $375 per lane mile to $1,500 per lane mile. As I said, there are several types of inspection processes the developer may utilize. They can either use the normal VDOT inspection process, in which case the full inspection and surety requirements will apply, or they can use a third-party inspection process, in which case the inspection fee will be reduced by 75%, and the length of the surety requirements will be reduced from 3 years to 1 year. There's also an option for the developer to use a local certification process, which currently is in place with Prince William, and that is where the department and the local governing body execute an agreement where the local government will take care of the inspection process. And these options are intended to provide incentives for developers to use a more detailed inspection process without placing additional burden on VDOT staff. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions the board may have.
Okay, questions for Mr. Donahue.
Quick question. Would local governments be able to contract out that inspection?
As written process? Today, I believe that would be the case, yes.
Second, is there any estimate of the time requirement that the district administrators will be burdened with for these appeals, the meetings, let me leave it at that. Have you made an estimate? Do you expect this to be a big set of appeals, or just sort of a now and then?
I do not anticipate the amount of appeals will be significantly higher than those that are received today. One of the things we've been moving forward with the traffic impact analysis regulations and the access management regulations is placing time constraints on VDOT's response for such appeals. That is something that has been requested by the private sector, and VDOT staff have indicated that they believe it can be accomplished.
Final question, Mr. Chairman. This doesn't preclude any subsequent legal processes that are legal options that developers may have in terms of other appeals or legal actions or other kinds of things.
This would not restrict any legal options the developer may pursue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nick, under design requirements, there's a statement that says neo-traditional development section is removed. What's that all about?
In the previous requirements, there was a section related to neo-traditional developments. That language has been removed from the draft regulation, and the reason it's been removed is not because we're no longer consider such developments, but because we hope at the time this initiative is complete, it will no longer be something that requires an exception process.
I don't follow you.
The current language was in there to allow certain street widths and other considerations, such as parking and stormwater runoff and utility placement, that may not have been allowed under the previous standards. We believe that most of those issues have been addressed in the existing draft regulation, and so we've removed that section because we no longer believe exceptions and appeals will be necessary to do what was intended with that language.
Okay, so that the standards have basically been incorporated into the new
flexibility to allow such standards has been incorporated.
Okay. Smaller streets.
Okay, any other questions or concerns? Ms. Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nick, I believe at the beginning of your presentation that you stated of the MPOs that you would be visiting. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. And I know that, of course, George Washington region MPOs, I think that you stated you would be there. How do we get material out to localities so that they will attend these meetings?
I've been working with the executive directors of the regional commissions and the planning district commissions to forward that information to the affected localities. So I've been in contact with Bob Wilson from the George Washington Regional Commission. So
right.
I believe Bob will take it upon himself to distribute those materials to the appropriate mm-hmm. local staff.
All right. Have you already given them information that they need at this time when you would be presenting it to the George Washington MPO?
That date is still tentative due to the General Assembly session. Tentatively scheduled it for the 5th of March. However, I have explained to the executive directors that I cannot promise that time frame. We'll have to get back to them, at the beginning of that week to let them know if I will be able to attend just due to the constraints of this session.
I just have not seen anything about it, whatever. And it bothers me if the MPOs are not getting the word out to local governments.
Well, and this was just arranged earlier this week, so that may be the reason that no information has been sent out. But I will check back with Bob and make sure that he does contact the appropriate staff.
All right, and would you let me know on that, please?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, very important homework assignment for each of you to do the very hard, nitty-gritty work of reading through this regulation, and we are a very diverse commonwealth, and what works in Mr. Bowie's district probably does not work in Mr. Kulame's district.
Amen.
So you need to read that with that in mind to bring that very diverse set of real-world experiences there on regulation that has to apply statewide. We will not achieve perfection in this, but we will achieve a good regulation that allows us to achieve the ultimate goal here, which is to minimize our long-term maintenance impacts. That maintenance budget, that's what's killing us right now. We've got growth in the maintenance budget that's hurting our construction program, number one. And number two, if we're going to integrate better transportation and land use, we do have to think about things like connectivity. This is tied in with the performance measures for the regional areas, in particular Hampton Roads in North Virginia. These things all do have to fit together. But I think all of us recognize, again, that geographic and economic diversity of the Commonwealth. We have to make sure that that diversity is fairly reflected. And so your personal attention and review and providing those comments directly to Nick, you should feel free to obviously comment, discuss with district staff to get that flavor. And please, the sooner you get that information, that commentary to Mr. Donahue, the sooner we can get this into a shape where the Commonwealth Transportation Board has advertised this for public comments too. And we'll be hopefully be able to take that up in an affirmative fashion at our March meeting. Okay? Thank you, Mr. Donahue. I see you are number three on this agenda with Virginia Capital Trail. I know you'll do a very brief overview of this issue.
I certainly will, Mr. Chair. Members of the board here today provide you an update on the Virginia Capital Trail. The Virginia Capital Trail is a 55-mile-plus shared-use path that will run from downtown Richmond through Jamestown to Williamsburg when complete. It will connect Richmond, the current capital, with two colonial capitals of Virginia, Jamestown and Williamsburg. The Capital Trail has been a project that has aspects of which have been contemplated for a long time. The first phase of the Capital Trail was completed in 1957 as bike lanes to the Colonial Parkway, which ran from Williamsburg to Jamestown. After that, not much progress was made on the Capital Trail. In 1999, a feasibility study was conducted by the Gilmore administration. That feasibility study was picked up by the Warner administration under, I believe, Mr. Jimmy Carr, who you all are familiar with. This was his project as a governor's fellow. He was very successful moving it forward. In 2005, construction began on the initial phases of the trail. At that time, the trail also received its East Coast Greenway Corridor designation. The East Coast Greenway, when complete, will be a system of trails that will run from Maine to Florida. In 2007, constructions of additional phases began, and the Chickahominy Riverfront and Green Strings phase of the trail opened to the public. The project has several goals and benefits. It hopes to connect local parks, trails, recreational amenities, and historical sites along the corridor, such as Berkeley Plantation, Sherwood Forest Plantation, the BC Rice Center, and other amenities. It hopes to also enhance recreation and promote healthier lifestyles. It will provide alternative transportation along the corridor in accordance with the CTV bike ped accommodation policy, and we hope it will promote tourism by providing connections between those resources along the Route 5 corridor. The trail was initially VDOT was trying to attempt to construct the trail as a whole project. However, after several years with little progress, they realized that was not the appropriate approach, and in an attempt to move this project forward, it is now being constructed in phases. There are currently 8 phases to the trail, and as I said, the trail is an 8 to 10 foot wide shared-use separate path for its entirety. The most complex and pressured phases have received priority. The 1999 feasibility study said that 52 miles of the 55 miles they were certain could be built. There was a 3-mile segment in James City County that they weren't so sure how they were going to make that connection. I'm happy to say that that was the first section of the trail that was open for public use last year. This project has been advanced using local, private, and interagency partnerships. It's important to note that the funding for this trail has not come from highway funding, but rather from dedicated funding sources that cannot be used for highway construction. And in recognition of the importance of the historic and cultural importance of this corridor, the trail is being designed using context-sensitive solutions and using the right-of-way wherever possible. This is a map for the board to see. It shows all the phases of the trail running from Williamsburg through Jamestown, then along Route 5 up to Richmond. And now I'd just like to go very quickly through some of the phases of the trail. The green phase of the trail is a 3-mile segment in James City County that connects Jamestown settlement with Route 5. It includes a 40-acre wilderness preserve. The Chickahominy Riverfront phase is a 5-mile section of the trail that runs from the Green Springs phase of the trail to the new Route 5 bridge over the Chickahominy River. Both of these phases of the trail are now open for public use. And moving along just east from west, the next phase of the trail is the Sherwood Forest phase. It is named so after the Sherwood Forest Plantation, which was the home to former U.S. President John Tyler. This is a 14-mile phase of the trail, and design and public involvement are currently underway, and we hope construction will begin in early 2010. The next phase of the trail is the Charles City Courthouse phase. This is an 8-mile phase linking the new visitor center in Charles City County with the VCU Rice Center, and construction began earlier this year. The next phase of the trail is the New Market Heights phase. It's a 12-mile phase linking the VCU Rice Center with a planned J. Sergeant Reynolds Community College campus at the intersection of Route 5 and Interstate 295, and design is expected to begin late this year. An additional phase of the trail is a Randolph Landing phase. This will run from Route 5 down to a new, 80-acre park that Henrico County is planning. This is 100% privately financed. It's being built by H.H. Hunt as part of their Wilton development. And this is a spur of the trail that we hope in the future will allow a riverside loop with new development along the river in Henrico County. The next phase of the trail is the Verina phase. This is a 7-mile long phase which links the trail from the J. Sergeant Reynolds campus, to several new developments along in the Route 5 corridor, including Rockets Landing and Tree Hill Farm, which both incorporate the trail, and design work is expected to begin shortly. And the final phase of the trail is the Richmond Riverfront phase, and this phase of the trail is currently under construction and is being completed in segments that progress with development. And this phase of the trail serves an extension from the canal walk and will run into the new planned developments in eastern Henrico and eastern Richmond. When complete, this trail will hopefully be a world-class amenity for the region and the Commonwealth, and will provide the ability for families and others to use to visit many of the historic resources along the corridor. Governor Kane participated in the ribbon cutting for the Green Spring phase and has stated that the administration is committed to having all phases of the trail either complete or under design at the end of his administration. And one of the purposes of this briefing is at the next meeting the board will consider a resolution to designate the Virginia Capitol Trail Corridor. And this resolution will recognize the alignment and importance of the trail and will ensure that all future projects along the corridor will consider the trail. And with that, with the indulgence of the chair, I would like to recognize Emily Peter, who is the VDOT project manager, who is here with us today. Emily's back there. She's been a great asset for the trail. I know she's a great asset for the department, and she's just done a wonderful job in this project. And if we could all just thank her for her work, I appreciate that.
Welcome, Emily. Great work. Congratulations. Thank you. Questions, Mr. Donahue?
Chairman, I probably should know this, but will all the trail be open for hiking and bicycles?
Yes, sir, it will be.
Any part of it open to horseback?
That has not been determined, though there may be some conflicts in the future if heavy horse usage occurs.
Any other questions or comments? I know you'll be working closely with Mr. McCarthy, particularly on the Henrico and Richmond area, where there are some planning issues yet to be worked out.
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Oh, it's just a kind of public relations. It seems to me just an ideal vehicle for tourists, for B&Bs or little restaurants. That has to come probably after we have more of it open. But do you hear rumblings of things of that nature?
We have heard a lot of things from the counties and various developers along the corridor. And several developers, actually, Neeson, Henrico, Neeson, and Richmond, have asked to incorporate the trail into the development and will be paying for the construction of the trail.
Because they see it as a real asset.
They see it as something that will improve their development on this great amenity.
Great. It's a wonderful program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next item is the Argonaut Biofuels item. Before Mr. Page, okay, you're going to be the next item. Argonaut Biofuels and Mr. Kevin Page from the Department of Agricultural Transportation talking about this rail webinar.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. This is under standard protocol with the board. This is a 30-day pre-action briefing on Argonaut Biofuels, LLC, which is to be located in the community of Bumpus in Louisa County. Argonaut Biofuels manufactures wood pellets for the use of fuel and also does skimming and shredding for animal bedding and other processes that can be used in paper mills. Wood pellets are part of what they manufacture for pellet stoves. It's an environmentally friendly, renewable resource and will help reduce Virginia's dependence on imported fuels. We have a $16 million project here, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, and that includes the purchase of an existing wood chip mill facility and a site that will significantly be expanded, as you see in the photographs coming up. This site is located on the Buckingham Branch Railroad, and Argonaut Fuels today does not have a connection to the Buckingham Branch, hence the need for the rail industrial access application. The project location, as I said earlier, was along the Buckingham Branch Railroad. For the members of the board that may recall, the Buckingham Branch leases from CSX a 200-mile rail section that also travels from Richmond to Clifton Forest through Louisa County. The construction of about 1,900 feet would be the encompassing in this project. Estimated project cost is $720,000. It would be about 1,000 rail cars per year is estimated to be shipped once the facility is up and running. And that's the equivalent of a 3-to-1 split with the type of tonnage that they'll be shipping at 3,000 trucks per year that would be shipped by rail equivalent. 43 new jobs will give a total of 65 total jobs for that facility. It was endorsed by Louisa County's Board of Supervisors. This project was in January, and it also assists in the initiatives conducted and undergoing by the Virginia Economic Development Partnership. Again, our applicant is Argonaut Biofuels, LLC. The total project cost for rail is $720,000. Of that, $450,000 has been requested by Argonaut, which requires a $150,000 match to be for the $450,000. Just for the board's reference, it's a $600,000 rail industrial access project, and any costs incurred above that amount, Argonaut Biofuels has agreed to pay for. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation to the board on Argonaut Biofuels, and I'll be glad to have you, and happy to turn the floor back over to you for any questions the board may have.
Questions or comments? There will be an action item at the March 6th meeting.
Yes, sir.
Okay, the next item on the agenda, actually the next two items, relate to the IA-1 corridor. The first is a rail corridor project update. At the conclusion of that, I know Mr. Tucker wanted to make some generic comments about the rail process for
the I've got to get through this one, Mr. Chairman. Pulled up the wrong one. Getting ahead of myself here. Okay, here we go. Mr. Chairman, before you today, I'll be giving a brief presentation on an update on the I-81 rail corridor. This is in reference to and follow-up to our November presentation before the board in Roanoke and also to bring you up to date on the activities of our Rail Enhancement Fund contract agreement that we've executed with Norfolk Southern on the particular improvements that were funded with the $40 million that we recently received through the General Assembly. As the board may remember and recall Norfolk Southern's presentation on the I-81 Crescent Corridor, this map is before you today just to refresh the board of their memory of the I-81 Crescent Corridor, particularly and respectfully of the fact that there are parallel facilities of Norfolk Southern that make up the I-81 Crescent Corridor. And of that, the major project area that you see circled in blue is what we refer to as a major choke point that has been established and recognized by both the MIROP study as far back as 2000 and any study that's come there forward that I'll be also talking about in just a minute. And that's particularly the rail line between Manassas and Front Royal, Virginia. And again, this is an exploded version of where we are in Virginia. Another thing, too, to note, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, where you see those high-colored yellow dots are distribution centers that use containerized freight or freight that's shipped by truck in Virginia along the I-81 corridor and also the I-95 and 64 corridors. As we look today over the next 2007 to 2035, the I-81 corridor highway traffic volume has a projected growth of using the base of up to 157% by the year 2035. Of that amount, we can also look at this as a corridor development project. There is a rail component to this project that has the ability to also ship freight within that transportation corridor. Of that amount, Mr. Chairman, over time from 2007 to 2035, you can see there would be a 39% increase in freight comparatively. Part of the strategy that we have for improvement for the corridor, as the CTB has acknowledged over time, is that there's both a highway and rail corridor need for additional capacity to meet future demand in this corridor. It's not a highway corridor, it's not a rail corridor, it's a transportation corridor as we tend to look at it. And how we go about planning for those improvements and strategies that are underway is that we're trying to provide additional passenger freight capacity for both modes. That's both for passenger rail, freight rail, and also auto and truck capacity. And also to see, as an agency, is how we can divert additional freight traffic to rail. Funding constraints have necessitated the phasing of the improvements. We have the short-term highway improvements, and this information was provided by VDOT. As you can see, we're dealing with the environmental impact study of I-81 and some of the short-term improvements that they have underway and also in the six-year program. For rail's component in this project, we have the short-term rail improvements of the I-81 freight rail study, which is underway, Mr. Chairman, and also the Manassas to Front Royal Corridor improvements, which encompasses that $40 million project that I'll be getting into a little more detail in just a minute. I want to just reflect back, if I may, Mr. Chairman, to 2003. The issues of the transportation corridor as a whole development and truck diversion has been something that was studied by the agency in our Southwest Midwest Corridor Marketing Study. It's known as the Reavy Study, and the Reavy Associates Study basically looked at an in-state development and a multi-state development and assessment for diverting freight from truck to rail in the I-81 corridor. As respectful of those results, we were anywhere from $7.3 billion to $7.9 billion for an overall multi-state improvement, with $1.35 billion in 2003 dollars acknowledged and identified in Virginia. Of that amount is a truck diversion for Virginia was about a 28 to 30% truck diversion. Now remember, that's an entire multi-state corridor initiative to warrant that type of diversion. The medium-term capital investment for Virginia-only projects was identified around $490 to $501 million of cost, and the truck diversion for I-81 was anywhere from around 9.8% to 10.4% for total trucks, respectfully to the fact that an investment has to be continued to be made in rail in order for them to maintain market share, because as this time you'll find that truck increases in volume on 81 as well. The medium-term rail investments for Virginia only will provide a capacity of anywhere from 474,501 additional rail cars per year or truck equivalents. This was a kind of driving force of the General Assembly and others for allocating the funds, and that was the basis for the $40 million for the I-81 rail improvements from Manassas to Front Royal segment. The I-81 freight rail study, I'd like to just bring the board up to speed on that as well. This is a study document that is still in development and underway. We hope to have that completed by the spring of 2008. Again, as I briefed the board in November, this, just to bring you up to speed, is a multi, both private and public initiative where Norfolk Southern has agreed to work with us and share with us their information on modeling and capacities of the corridor. And this project deals in the 500-mile differential from outside of the borders of Virginia to include Tennessee, Pennsylvania, and New York. We're also looking at a far outreaching opportunity to look at new technologies of roll-on and roll-off technologies as well. The project area conditions today is that we are dealing respectfully with the most congested portion of the rail corridor. This is back to the $40 million project. This line section between Manassas and Front Royal is typically known today as a one-way track. Trains are so long today that the passing sidings that were actually designed and built back in the 1800s and 1900s cannot accommodate for trains to get out of the way for other trains to pass. There is no signal system to control the rail traffic, which means you have to literally run that entire line on what they call verbal track warrants, which the dispatcher tells the trains what to do. And also there's no commuter rail service in the Gainesville-Haymarket area. And we saw an opportunity through this project as well, Mr. Chairman, not only to quantify the public benefit for the truck and container traffic, but also see an opportunity where we can work more respectfully to grow and enhance passenger rail in this corridor. Speaking respectfully to the project itself, under contract, there are four siding extensions along the Manassas to Front Royal section. That's Gainesville, Marshall, Delaplaine, and Whitecut. And also, we have incorporated in that an additional 5 miles of double track, which runs behind the Virginia Inland Port. It's very critical that the Virginia Inland Port project move forward as well, because that's where the trains that run up and down the what we know as the Shenandoah Valley Line connect to the line that comes over from Manassas. So there's an extreme choke point there, as I said earlier, was been identified as far back as 2000 in the Meroff's study. I just went through the description here in front of the map. These are some numbers to provide the board with where the cost differentials are and the rail control system, as well as a 50.9-mile system. When I look more respectfully to try to put this in perspective, provided this project can get up and running very quickly, which there's a schedule and timeline that I'll talk about in just a minute, we're looking today at the market share of what's out there for truck volumes in the corridor. That's rail and freight traffic on a one-to-one basis. Provided that the truck numbers stay the same and the rail numbers stay the same, we're looking at a growth in market share from 9.6% to 10.9% because of the growth of capacity that we're adding to this corridor today. The project benefits and economic impacts that we have calculated, as this board may recall, under the policies and procedures for the Rail Enhancement Fund, in order to meet the code criteria of Virginia, is that we have to identify and establish that there is a public benefit equal to or in excess or greater than one. In that, the way that we work through that is that we have a public benefit analysis and a process that we work through within the agency to determine public benefits over time. Of this $40 million project, $17.14 million is being provided as cash match by Norfolk Southern for a project total of $57 million. In addition to that, Mr. Chairman, it has a public benefit cost ratio based over 15 years of a 1.03% recovery. The project will pay for itself in 15 years and will have an internal rate of return of 4%. Additional benefits that we calculate as an agency, in addition to what we consider to be the statutory requirements of the Rail Enhancement Fund, are those of the talking points of fuel savings, carbon dioxide emissions avoided, and also we look at employment and additional rail capacity. Under the fuel savings, we have about an average of 4 million gallons a year, and that's predicated over the 15-year period of the 597,000 containers that will be diverted or carried over the line, in addition due to the capacity project. Carbon dioxide emissions is an average of 10,100 tons per year. We put that in vehicle equivalents because people drive cars and automobiles, so they can kind of relate to that. And we also see over the 15-year period 151,800 tons of carbon dioxide avoided, or 33,500 vehicle equivalents. This project will create 9 full-time new jobs, and that's obviously with train crews, and the additional rail capacity will allow for the addition of 6 to 10 new trains and increases the capacity of train service from about 60% to 100%. Remember now, we're taking normal passing sidings and we're doubling the length of them so that we can haul trains, Norfolk Southern can, that is. We can extend those train lengths to 8,000 to 9 or 10,000 train feet. It also allows, through this contract agreement, I want to give our agency head, Matt Tucker, full credit for this. He also incorporated the agreement and negotiated with Norfolk Southern that there would be a provision in this agreement that allows for these improvements not to interfere with passenger rail service and also assist in making rail service available through the capacity improvements and the placement of those improvements both at Gainesville-Haymarket and further points to the west. Just our project schedule, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, planning, design, and engineering began in January of 2008 with the execution of the agreement. Mm-hmm. And construction of the project we were hopeful would start in February of 2008 with the completion by December 31st of this year. We do have some challenges of getting some environmental approval, say some easements that have to be addressed throughout the project area. Mindful and respectful of the geographic locations of these projects, there are some easements that have to be addressed by Norfolk Southern and others in control of those easements so that we can move this project forward in a most effective manner. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, this project eliminates a major rail choke point. As I mentioned earlier, Riverton Junction has been on the books for many years as being a real choke point in that area. It also provides for the potential capacity improvements that would help VRE service expansion in the Gainesville-Haymarket area. One of the most key components of that is the long siding at Gainesville, and also the signalization control system of this rail line will allow for us to work with VRE to advance the Gainesville-Haymarket in a seamless and effective way where train speeds can be kept up because they have the signalization. This is a first step in a down payment, Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned earlier in the Reedy study. $500 million gets you about 10% diversion. And this is for a quarter wide of rail improvements. And a project is just in its initial first part of a phase one improvement process. Multi-state improvement over time is what it's going to take to really make a big difference over and above what we're looking at in Virginia for diversions. And the next steps that we will be coming back to this board with the I-81 freight rail study sometime this spring. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my my presentation. I'll open the floor for questions and comments.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Page, the projection of 39% increase in freight rail, is that based on market demand alone, or does that anticipate these capital investments being made?
We have tried to establish our criteria of growth based on the containers that Norfolk Southern has committed to us, in addition to the numbers that they're putting together for the Crescent Corridor Initiative. What we're looking at today, Mr. Bowie, is that we have a commitment from Norfolk Southern that they will perform a threshold level of containers on an annual basis through these $40 million of improvements. And through that performance benefit, if they fail to meet that diversion performance, they pay us back per container plus interest of the prevailing rate set by the General Assembly for that year.
Well, will the increased capacity that comes with these capital investments improve that 39% increase in freight rail, or is that the optimum that's being shot for?
Well, it's a very good question, Mr. Bowie. Today, Norfolk Southern operates 255 days a year of intermodal business on this line. If Norfolk Southern were to change its operating footprint to add an additional day of service or more days of service, there's 100 days of service that are still a potential for capacity. So by creating these capacity improvements, we can increase the number of trains that can be operated per weekday. And also, if Norfolk Southern is able to grow the market share, the capacity would increase as well based on the operating footprint of the railroad.
So, in sum, I think the answer to that question, Mr. Page, is that the 39% could be, that's market-based growth that could be accommodated with operational changes.
Yes, sir.
The capital enhancements here would be either in the same times, doing more within the same time slots that are currently, be more efficient use of existing time slots.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
With the expenditure of the capital from the Commonwealth to support Norfolk Southern, at the end of that, who owns these sidings and what is the benefit to the Commonwealth other than the things you've talked about?
The benefit to the Commonwealth, first I'll address the ownership issue. Under the contract itself, we under the Rail Enhancement Fund are purchasing a public performance, a public benefit. Through that public benefit period, which has been established as 15 years, the Commonwealth of Virginia owns an ownership interest in that facility, which is diminished by the performance level of the railroad. So each year as that performance goes forward, the ownership of that rail facility diminishes in the Commonwealth's contingent interest. At the end of that period, a 15-year period, they have met that performance of what we have purchased, Mr. Davis, and that ownership will end.
Who owns it?
Does
that mean that the railroad owns it after 15 years?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Okay. What?
If I could just jump in right there, the Rail Enhancement Fund is a, and you've heard people say Virginia's on the cutting edge, what we are buying is public benefits. We are not buying tangible assets, and it's a little bit like an economic development prospect. If you hit certain employment targets, you get a tax credit. or you retain an incentive grant. If those targets are not held, there is a clawback provision for the Commonwealth. Mr. Tucker is going to talk a little bit in more detail. Let's finish up on I-81 specifically and come back to this issue generically.
Well, that was exactly my real question, is the public benefit over 15 years. Project will pay for itself in 15 years. What exactly does that mean, the project will pay for itself in 15 years?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. McCarthy, for your question. Under the public benefit analysis that we conduct and perform for every one of our rail enhancement projects, a public benefit is generated over a plethora of component pieces, one of which is cost avoidance for pavement maintenance and highway construction costs brought about by the fact that we're actually buying a public benefit of diverting trucks off of highway systems that would otherwise be using them in Virginia. And also, we look at employment. We also look at accident cost avoidance from the highways. There's a component, a group of indicators that go together into this benefit cost analysis that come out at the end of the day to show that what the cost avoidance is for highway lane maintenance. The fact that we're not having accidents on the highway system. There's also an environmental aspect to this for air pollution, as I mentioned earlier. So all of that has a value assessed to it, and that's the calculation of the value is embanked over the 15-year payback period of the performance that we would be purchasing with that investment.
One final question about that.
Let me just further expand upon it. I think by statute, we're required to establish public benefit before we invest the funds. We secure the public benefit for the life of the investment that we make with performance. So in the case of this agreement, it really boils down to we're locking them into a performance for additional trucks moved by rail over the course of the 15-year period, and that provides a direct payback and benefit to the Commonwealth that we ensure is maintained through the life of the agreement. That's the relationship at the end of the day, is that we've identified a public benefit at the baseline today. They agreed to a performance that has to be carried through for the life of the agreement.
And one hopes thereafter, I assume.
From a private sector approach, you would assume that they are going to continue to be in business and continue wanting to grow their market.
There is one other aspect of this that you mentioned briefly, but if you can't talk about it, fine, but if you can, what exactly, where are we on this conservation easement that would have to be vacated for this project to go where they want to put it, which is a real public policy question, I'm afraid, but where are we on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McCarthy, thank you for asking for that update. I attended the Virginia Outdoors Foundation board meeting last month. That project, there are three Virginia Outdoor Foundation held easements in the Riverton, what they call the Marsh Run to Riverton project. Of those three easements, the Norfolk Southern has approached for the conversion diversion under 10.1-1704 of the Code of Virginia. It's my understanding, and I will be attending the March meeting of the VOF in Charlottesville to move forward with Norfolk Southern answering the questions that were asked of them of the VOF board, and also clarify what the impacts would be to the easements that they're asking for. Today, and I want to be clear about this, today the request is for the use of VOF easements, the conversion diversion. Some of those are like anywhere from 5 to 10 foot slivers of land that run alongside Norfolk Southern for the use of their ditch line or slope line, because in some areas the tracks are actually elevated above the ground line. There is no intent by Norfolk Southern through the plans and specifications that have been provided to us for them to actually construct railway facilities on these easements. It's just the use of them for a ditch line or a slope line for the construction of the rail facility.
Mr. Page, from our past conversations, doesn't the math have to work differently here? In other words, doesn't the growth in rail volume have to be a multiple of the growth in truck volume for us to really divert trucks?
And that's a very good question, and one that was brought out in the Reby study, is that in order for us to continue to maintain market share, we have to continue to gain in the capacity of the railroad, that either the railroad change its operating practices or we work to make greater capacity improvements to maintain market share with growth. And that is a moving target, Mr. Coulomb, and I want to be perfectly frank with you on that, is that there's a transportation decision that has to be made on the I-81 corridor about rail and highway systems and to the relationship of if rail grows, how does highway grow? Where we have right now is we have kind of a surge of capacity we're creating through this $40 million project that will allow us to keep up market share, but as I-81's growth continues to grow, then obviously more improvements will have to be made or changes will have to be made in operating practices in order for that.
Your figures say truck volumes growing can grow four times faster than rail volumes.
That's correct.
We're just falling behind, and I wonder at $40 million a pop whether we ever sort of catch up there or if the highway lanes make
them. 10% or 10%.
Right.
Let's not kid ourselves.
Yeah.
It's a good, worthy investment, but when you look at the needle is moving about 1% increase in the market share of rail, of the toll freight movements in that corridor.
Mr. Chairman.
And without further investment, that needle will move back.
Mr. Chairman, after listening to about 9 hours of testimony on this particular issue of use of freight in the I-81 corridor, I have to sit here and sort of be amused that we're talking about buying services from a private railroad for 15 years when we compare it to the investment in the road where the Commonwealth owns it. And it's an interesting mixture of an approach in today's environment of not wanting to invest in infrastructure appropriately, but I find it really troubling and have throughout all these discussions of trying to educate the public to the fact that if they want rail, this is like piddling to get a little bit of help, but it is not the investment that really needs to be made in true infrastructure. The example being that route across there should be double rail. Now, I understand it goes through easements and a lot of other things, but the only thing that will really help eventually is to double rail that corridor. And I think we kid ourselves, and I think in the public hearings and the things that I sat through, I tried to speak back to the audience and say, if you really want rail, you're talking about a Commonwealth investment. And I don't see any other way to do it. Now, the kind of investment we're doing here, I believe in the public benefit argument. I think it comes. But it's not really looking to the long-term future to solve any serious part of the problem, in my view.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. I would say after this bottleneck, which ultimately over enough time could be solved with Commonwealth investments, the next set of large investments are outside of Virginia.
Yeah.
And so when you stand back and remember, look at your map on pages 2 and 3. Those
yep.
are the things that matter. This is a national issue. And so there are investments that have to be made in Memphis, in New Orleans, in the West Coast ports to interface with some of the East Coast railroads. And this is not an issue that can be solved in Virginia alone. This is an issue that will require a federal partnership to make it.
You've been in a lot of those meetings, I know, talking about it. I'm just curious, is there any conversation of an approach to it like the interstate system to actually deal with this freight rail issue as an interstate highway project, similar to what we did in the 50s and 60s with the interstate? That, to me, that's what's required. And
There have been some as part of precursors to reauthorization. There is effectively a prohibition on taking federal highway trust funds and putting them into rail corridors in the way that we do it here in Virginia.
Yep.
So I think there are some technical things that can be done. But at the end of the day, this will require, just like the interstate system, dedicated, sustained revenues that cut across a number of states and regions to make it work. And importantly, to provide interfaces at major places like Kansas City or the Port of Hampton Roads or crossing the border into Canada or down into Mexico. This is not even just a U.S., it really is a global issue.
Mr. Chairman,
Ms. King.
Also, to realize the return that we're going to get in this 15 years here in the northern part, don't we have to make an investment or a port in the Roanoke Valley to realize all of that? I mean, they go hand in hand because it's all the traffic in that corridor.
Yes, sir. And that's an excellent observation. Part of this rail investment is economic. And Mr. Tucker released about a month ago now, 3 weeks ago, the economic analysis of an intermodal facility in the Roanoke Valley. As we know from Front Royal, those benefits are considerable. If they do not accrue to the Roanoke Valley, they will go likely to Tennessee or Ohio. We are in competition with those states for those public and private investments. Thank you for bringing that up. Mr. Schwartz, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of different comments. First, just to react and in many respects agree with the comments of Dr. Davis. I think it's right that this particular $40 million investment is just the tip of the iceberg if we really expect to have any kind of meaningful freight-to-rail diversion. But I'm intrigued by some of the numbers, Kevin, that you have in here, where you talk about a Virginia-only investment of about $1.3 billion as part of a corridor-long investment of about $7 or $8 billion. And this goes to the Secretary's comment as well, relating to the need for other states and the federal government to participate. But I think there's a real leadership opportunity for Virginia here as we proceed with and come to the conclusions of this freight rail study, where we have the ability to go to the federal government and to go to the other states and say, there is a great multi-state and national benefit here. We will make our share of the investment, the $1.3 billion, if you will all make your respective shares of that investment. And then what I look at is I look at the potential capacity increases for freight of the $1.3 billion investment for Virginia versus the roughly $11 billion investment that we were talking about for the widening and the truck lanes on 81. And so I think in that context, you can look at the larger freight-to-rail and rail system investments here as potentially leveraging the participation of contributions from other states as a huge and very efficient economic benefit. Now, with respect to the specific line that runs from Manassas to Front Royal, I'd be remiss if I didn't put a slightly more critical gloss on your characterization of the easement issue. And I want to preface my remarks by saying that in concept and in general, I'm very supportive of this particular investment. But the reality is that Norfolk Southern, for whatever reasons, approached the issue of the easements, the conservation easements along this line, in a very cavalier and insensitive manner. Now, why it happened, I don't know, but I do know that at the beginning of this process and at the time that we agreed to provide this money, they weren't even aware that these easements existed, and they should have been, and we should have told them. The fact of the matter is that there may well be ways to make this investment along this line without impacting existing conservation easements, whether they're held by counties or municipalities or whether they're held by VOF. I do recognize that in some cases the actual physical impact on the easement is not large from an acreage standpoint, but there is an underlying issue here of the expectations that people have when they make conservation easements. And as you know, the governor's stated goal of getting 400,000 acres under conservation easements during his administration is very much a function, the success of that is very much a function of people making those easements. And that's very much a function of their expectations that the land that they're easing will be preserved actually is preserved. And so there's more than the issue of the actual physical impact on these particular easements in question. I would hope that in the future when we make grants of this nature that will be more sensitive to the environmental and the conservation easement issues and will impart that sensitivity as a standard to Norfolk Southern or whoever we might be dealing with. And then just one other comment to respond to Dr. Davis's point about double tracking versus sidings. It's just an interesting side observation to mention that many of the folks who are concerned about the impact of these improvements on conservation easements have expressed the fact that they would be far less concerned if this track, if this line were double tracked its entire length, which may seem counterintuitive, but isn't. And the reason that it isn't is because Norfolk Southern has a rather unfortunate habit of using these sidings that are really supposed to be just so trains can pass on these single lines as storage yards. And so in these eased areas, there's the potential for basically 24/7, 365 storage of vast long chains along these two-mile sidings of freight cars that aren't being used. They are using some of the existing sidings along the line in that manner. If it were a double track, that wouldn't happen. And if it were a double track, as a result of that, the visual impact in these areas would actually be far, far less than it is as sidings. Now, I know that Norfolk Southern's been approached to make a commitment that these sidings would only be used for their stated intended purpose, which is as passing lanes, essentially, and not as storage sidings. And my understanding is, as of yet, they've not risen to the challenge of agreeing to that. It's something to consider, but I just wanted to point that out in the context of your comment of double tracking the entire line, because it could be that while that would be more efficient, it would also be less impactive on the easement areas. And I would just close by saying that, well, I think we're very much on the right track with these kinds of investments, and I commend you for it. I would hope in the future there will be more focus on the conservation easements, because I think that the railroads need to know that the state's support for this kind of freight to rail investment is not a sort of carte blanche to do it in a way that doesn't show the appropriate sensitivity to the conservation easements, which are part of another stated goal. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartz. Mr. McCarthy, I think it's, as we get into rail investments, it strikes me that we face the same set of colliding interests we do on highway projects and port projects and airport projects. And I say to Norfolk Southern and CSS, come on in, the water's fine. I would also look to you, Mr. Schwartz, and you, Mr. McCarthy, to bring those folks to the table. We have to bring this to a conclusion. These projects do not get cheaper. And there is a public benefit here, which is good. And I know that Mr. Page and Mr. Tucker would welcome your assistance in that.
Thank you.
I'm very much interested in the potential for the VRE to move out west into Haymarket area. Mm-hmm. How potential is that potential? In other words, will the additional sidings and the signalization really provide the right format for that expansion, other than the political and the buying of the equipment? What else will be necessary?
Well, expansion of rail service was begun under study by this board's allocation of rail enhancement funds to the Gainesville Haymarket Extension Study, which VRE is in the process of getting ready to award a contractor today, you know, this very soon about that. There are two things for rail expansion. One is equipment. The other is the politics of operating matching capital. In addition to that, one of the challenges that's been on the books for many years is the fact that this rail line was not signalized. It did not have a train control system, which is almost mandatory these days if you're going to have a passenger rail operation in the United States. So having said that, this would provide the 50-some miles of signalization that would be necessary in order to expand passenger rail service far beyond Gainesville Haymarket. And also you have the additional track capacity by having that long siding at Gainesville Haymarket so that trains could work around potential VRE trains that might be serving a station within that crossing area where that siding is. So the answer is, I think the capital infrastructure is getting very close to being there. Then it's up to obviously the feasibility environmental study to be completed by VRE and then move forward with an implementation plan and strategy.
But could I have one follow-up? But because it still is a single track with sidings, we would have that competition between the passenger and the freight.
There's always somewhat of the way they operate the railroad and dispatch the railroad. They would have to adjust schedules to slot those trains in and out, or additional capacity may be negotiated with VRE.
And I would just add on that, part of the agreement really is to get Norfolk Southern to recognize that we do have plans for future passenger rail in the corridor. And what we talk specifically about in that process, where there may be opportunities for you to leverage some cost savings for the project, let us know those things. The signal system itself, which was embedded in this project, I think $18.5 million, is a direct write-down on the investment that VRE would have to make. So really the paragraph just essentially binds both parties to recognize that we have dual uses and plans for the corridor, and that we're going to consider those plans as we move forward, and nothing that they do will preclude passenger rail. It will only support passenger rail in the future in the corridor.
Thank you. I think it's worth remembering here that this project, it starts off of I-81 and is a further enabler for the extension of VRE service to Gainesville. So it serves the I-66 corridor for passenger purposes and I-81 for freight. There are very few projects that have that. So while we can worry about the downside of this, this is a unique opportunity to really do good in a lot of corridors. Mr. Tucker, you were going to give us a quick overview of the rail enhancement fund. I think, you know, given some of the discussion, it's probably good to refresh people's memory about the process for the rail enhancement fund.
Yeah, you know, and I'll just put it back in the context that the rail enhancement fund is still a very relatively new program. I mean, it was put in place by statute in 2005. Again, the underlying the code requirement is that we establish a public benefit for the program. And as the chair has alluded to, in most instances, while we may have a contingent interest in an asset, we are not attempting to acquire ownership. What we are doing is purchasing bulk public benefits and requiring someone to maintain that public benefit performance throughout the cycle of it. Now, one of the things that is also left out of that equation is the fact that us purchasing benefits, we're not inheriting maintenance costs. So as a matter of us executing this agreement, we're not executing an agreement with Norfolk Southern to cover their routine maintenance or operating costs. So that's a dramatically different discussion than we would have if we were building a highway system and inheriting that highway system. Someone would have to pay, someone from the Commonwealth would have to write that check. We're not writing that check. One of the things that I wanted to really comment about in terms of the rail enhancement fund itself is that as we sort of evolve the program, you know, we get a lot of discussions about where the program is headed strategically and for the future. Again, when you put it in the context that we're now developing the update to our statewide rail plan, that we're looking at how do we advance both passenger and freight rail initiatives concurrently. One of the things that I wanted to do moving forward is, one, we need to improve the level of communication. Mr. McCarthy and I had a discussion just before the meeting, and one of the things that I committed to do for Mr. McCarthy is that we're going to modify the rail enhancement fund process a little bit differently. If you recall, last year, as part of the budget process, you approved the allocation of the fund for this project. And so you go back to June of last year, then you move forward to January, and you hear about agreement. This sort of is a disconnect from a board perspective. You receive briefings in between that time, but what I want to do is sort of close the gap so that as these agreements actually come to fruition, sometimes it takes much longer than we ever contemplate, that the board is aware of how the deal comes together, the final stage. So what we're going to do moving forward is we're going to reach an interim agreement with grantees that allows the project to be included into the six-year plan, and then we will come back to the board just before we ratify that agreement to finalize that agreement, before the agreement is publicly announced. I think that will give the board, I think, a greater level of information and transparency about how the deal came together, what were the specific deal points were emphasized from both parties in terms of making it come together. And I hope that addresses some of the concerns that have been expressed to us. And again, I will take the hit, the mea culpa, in terms of the agency of the notice coming out and the board members not getting a pre-briefing of the fact that we were releasing the press release announcing the deal with Norfolk Southern. But we had sort of built up over the last few months of discussion that the deal was coming together rather quickly. The last thing I just want to emphasize is that when I look at the Rail Enhancement Fund program, sort of think of it as the context of that we put public transportation and some of the other things that we do in terms of transportation demand management. I think what I always tell people when I think about transportation, I talk about it in terms of toolboxes. What tools are you using to sort of mitigate your issues? And sometimes one tool doesn't solve the whole problem. If you look at the highways, there are infinitely more capacity on the highway than what we're going to have on our rail network unless we're going to fundamentally change the business paradigm. But let's make sure we keep it in the context of why we do public transportation, why do we encourage people to ride share, why do we want to get more things moved by freight. At the end of the day, I think it's a notion that we have to understand. We're going to have to continue to make capacity investments in highways. We're going to have to continue to make capacity investments in rail, public transportation, to continue to meet the ever-growing transportation needs to support our quality of lives and our economies. I just want to make sure we don't sort of lose thought with the process when we talk about trucks taking off the road. Don't take that literally, that truck is taken off the road and that truck is not replaced. One of the things we have to keep in mind in the context of ever and growing economy is that you're going to ever expect increasing market shares and growth across all modes. So I want to make sure that we keep that in the context, because when we use trucks taken off the road, sometimes it's simplified to a point that people actually think it's a truck physically taken off the road that's not replaced by any other truck. But that's not the case, and that's not what we're saying when we're talking about. That includes it.
Thank you, Mr. Tucker. Moving right along and staying within the I-81 corridor, we have a presentation on the I-81 truck climbing lanes. Chief Engineer Mel Curley is going to be doing a presentation, and Claude Mel's putting that up.
Switching base class and giving us something there.
Maps and graphics that will help us to understand. Welcome, Mr. Curley.
Thank you, sir. Dusty's passed out 11 by 17 of cross sections. I didn't know what you received in your packets. I didn't know how well you could see. You know, the little one that I had, I couldn't see too well. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the truck climbing lanes. In December of 07, we received notification from the Star Solutions team that they were declining further participation in improvements on the 81 corridor. We had staff had already been preparing plans and 30% plans on the truck climbing lanes, and we were prepared, if we could not enter into that test contract with them, to move forward as design build. So in January, we terminated all activities with the PPTA procurement on 81, and on January 22nd, we put out a design build request for qualifications for a Stanton truck climbing lanes, which I'll get to in a minute. We had an industry briefing in Lexington on February the 5th. 67 people showed up at that briefing. This shows you the two truck climbing lanes that we have. I'll go into detail a little bit more. One is in the Salem district, one's in the Stanton district. I'm going to talk, here's the Stanton district. It's in Rockbridge County. And the next slide here gives you the location. It's about 6.4 miles long. It's in the northbound direction on 81, and there's a change in elevation of about 664 feet in this 6.4 miles. The typical section is one passing lane, one travel lane, one truck climbing lane. We'll upgrade the paved shoulders, and there'll be three bridges that will impact, and I'll talk about them in a minute. The next sheet right here is the one that was just passed out to you. I wanted to comment on that because we are working with the Federal Highway Administration in this project and trying, you know, getting all approvals from them, because obviously this is an interstate highway. When we went to the public hearing, you have to remember there is a record of decision, and in that record of decision, based on the NEPA document, there's an expectation from the Federal Highway of what Virginia will be building on 81. The board was very clear in that we are going to do improvements along 81 as financings come forward, and we wanted to move forward with the truck climbing lane. The federal government does not want to preclude anything that in the ultimate would be from the NEPA document as we did that. So the first time we went to public hearing, you had a 30-foot shoulder area where you see on your area now you have 12-foot paved shoulder on the right side. This is the bottom section that you're seeing. You see a 12-foot paved shoulder and a 5-foot graded shoulder. What we went to public hearing was instead of 17 feet, we went to public hearing with 29 feet. In other words, the NEPA document shows an extra lane, and we were going to build the cross section because it was cheaper to build it now than build it in the future, build the cross section for the ultimate, but only grade and pave what we needed right now. When we went to the public hearing, there was concerns raised about the cross section, and also in that stretch of 81, there's farmland associated there, and the farm owners were concerned about taking that land. So what we did is we went back to the Federal Highway Administration to talk to them and basically said that we could do things not to preclude the ultimate section without building in this particular area that cross-section or that extra 12-foot lane. So, for instance, when we there's one bridge that crosses 81. What we'll do on that particular bridge is we will set the piers such that if ever in the future the board decided to build an extra lane, we would not have to impact that particular bridge. If we have a bridge on the main line, what we're going to do, or we proposed and reached agreement with the FHWA, is that normally you have a 12-foot shoulder. We were going to build, I think it's a 14-foot shoulder on that bridge, or a 15-foot shoulder. I can't remember exactly which one. And if we ever came back to widening again, if the board made that decision, then we could put another lane on that bridge without having to rebuild it. Our shoulder would just be smaller than it would normally be if we were building a brand-new bridge. So on the Stanton area, because there's not much rock cut, and because of the terrain, and because of working with the owners in that particular project, we will be using what we call the standard section, which was this section that you see right here. We had the public hearing in November 07. Like I said, we've made some changes to the cross-section because of that. We're looking for the statements of qualifications are due to VDOT by March of 08. We will shortlist those, however many that come in, and we will look to shortlist down to three, and we request proposals in May of 08. We'll see CTB and FHWA approvals of that design-build contract in October of 08, notice to proceed in November of 08, and estimated completion date is spring of 12. In Salem, it's a little bit different. You'll see here, and I'll talk about here on Salem. It's about an 8.6 miles. It's in the southbound direction, and there's a 754-foot change in elevation. There's the typical section will be the passing lane, the travel lane, the truck climbing lane. We'll upgrade the paved shoulders. We're impacting two new bridges and bridge widening. In this particular area, however, we are going through some significant rock cuts, and there's some fills in there. So the FHWA has said that we need to consider the ultimate section in here, because if we're going to go in there and we're going to cut through that rock, it's much, much cheaper for us to put an ultimate section in this particular area than it is to come back and have to have that additional expense later on. We are still looking at this particular area. There is a truck climbing lane right now. There is a study going on that they feel they may need another additional truck climbing lane there. But it would appear to me, I was looking at it the other day, and there is a mountain of rock right there by that truck. So I think maybe we can get more bang for our buck by adding on to the length of the truck climbing lane as opposed to try to improve that particular one right now. The anticipated milestones for the Salem is we're going to anticipate a public hearing in June of 08. We're going to request qualification to be issued in July of 08, and the proposals in October of 08. We'll come back to the CTB and FHWA approvals in April of 09, notice to proceed in May of 09, and estimated completion date in the fall of 2012. And that's a brief update of where we are on the truck climbing lane. Any questions?
Yes, sir. What does the typical truck climbing lane out there look like now? How long?
How long is it? I couldn't answer that question. And obviously, it's 12 foot wide. It's a normal lane. I don't know. Dusty, you know any lengths that on truck climbing lanes on 81 right now?
Well, the one in Irondale is about 2 miles to the top of the mountain,
Christopher
Mountain.
They run the length of the height, the level out.
Those are the only ones.
We don't have any. Expensive.
Buffalo Creek's 1.5, and on the other person's words, about maybe 2.5.
And in these segments that you're describing, are we talking about more or less straight uphill, or is this going
down? It goes uphill, then down a little bit, then uphill, and down a little bit. It's not a straight climb the whole way. But from the start to the stop of our mileage that we have, I gave the difference in elevation between those.
I mean, I guess that's what I'm trying to get my head around, is this an 8.5-mile segment is a highway project. That's not a truck climbing lane to the way I would look.
Well, I think the problem you would have with that, sir, is going in and out. Like if you went up a certain segment and then hit a flat segment, you've got to bring the trucks back into the traffic. Then you go, another 0.5 mile, then maybe you have to go back out and go back up. So it is one continuous truck climbing lane once we start.
Mr. Chairman. Those that ride 81 in the Stanton District would know that I think you did it often enough. There are two main sections that are about 10 miles long each that trucks run side by side all the time, and traffic drops down to 40 miles an hour for almost a 7 to a 10-mile stretch. And then all of a sudden it levels out and traffic can move on typically. And on Friday through Sunday, it is absolutely unbelievable. Trying to get through there and having a lane open all the time. So if you didn't run that whole length of those two sections, you'd be creating a really bad situation, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, I've certainly been stuck behind double trucks and can sympathize.
The recently completed Buffalo Creek project
yes.
seems to have fit the bottom graphic here. So my question is, are we quite comfortable that by switching to the middle graphic that will not have a negative impact in Stanton District on emergency vehicles or the case of breakdown that we'll still have?
The three graphics there. You have just show phase construction. The top is the first phase of the construction. We have to shift traffic to one side so we can build it. The second is we're shifting traffic again to build the other side. The completed cross section you'll see is at the bottom of the sheet of paper that you have.
But didn't you just say we would talk about narrowing the Stanton District?
I'm not sure. I did not show you what the Salem.
I'm asking about Stanton.
Right.
Are you talking about narrowing Stanton to narrower gauge than this?
No, this is the bottom cross section on the sheet of paper I gave you.
Okay.
Is exactly what will be built in. In the Stanton area, right.
Okay.
Yeah. And in the Salem area, you'll see the same cross section. You'll see the guardrail exactly at the same place you see here, but behind the guardrail there'll be additional grading for future if the board makes a decision.
I'm comfortable with Salem. You're not talking about narrowing that one.
Right, that's correct.
It's just the money you save up there, just send it down to Salem.
Now, on the Buffalo Creek Bridge and the Moy River Bridge, when those were designed, actually it's at the beginning of the Star Solutions proposal, and we were already into design, and they asked us to hold up on those particular projects because they would build it during the PPTA. But we never assumed we're going to enter into an agreement with the PPTA. We had a schedule on those. We moved forward. We did make them a little bit wider just in case we were going to come back in and put a lane through there later on so we wouldn't have to rebuild those bridges. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hurley. I'd like to finish up the last two items very quickly so we can take up the business agenda. The next item is the Universal Access Program update by Mr. Corey Hill, followed by a very brief legislative update. I think we've hit the high notes on legislation. Mr. Baldwin,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief. I've got a quick presentation for you all on a new program that DRPC is doing called the Universal Access Program. Quick background for you. The 2007 Virginia General Assembly directed DRPC to develop this program. The program is intended to improve service for paratransit riders in the Commonwealth. It specifically targets a visitor program for paratransit riders across regions and localities. It's consistent with our programmatic efforts to improve mobility for seniors and persons with disabilities. It's also going to allow us to ensure better consistency with respect to ADA service policy in the Commonwealth. Focusing for just a minute on...
Could you define what a visitor's program is?
I'll get to that in the next slide. Very quickly, just want to touch on what is ADA service. The 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act, Title II, requires that complimentary transit service must be provided within a three-quarter mile corridor of fixed-route bus service. Eligibility is established based on a person's functional ability, inability to complete a bus or rail trip. People apply to the local transit system to determine paratransit eligibility, and that's important for your question, Mrs. Connolly. And then as we get to general types of service, it's either door-to-door or curb-to-curb, and the fare is capped at 2 times the base fare for bus service. Where we are today is that currently folks that want to use paratransit service, they have to qualify for each system in the Commonwealth. What the current law, the American with Disabilities Act, requires, though, is that systems operating paratransit service must allow eligible riders up to 21 days of service throughout a calendar year as a visitor. So if I'm certified as eligible in my hometown by my home system, I can go visit another system and ride for up to 21 days under the current law with that eligibility that I get. What we're going to do, though, is we are going to expand that beyond the federal requirement so that if somebody wants to ride 22 days or more, that eligibility transfers automatically. It makes it much easier rather than having them to go through continuous certification processes, which is a huge barrier for many of these folks. DRPC is going to implement this new requirement with annual contracts with our grantees, and will also ensure consistency of the service operations across Virginia as part of our monitoring programs. Beyond the changes in the requirements, we're also going to be providing a lot more service to the community in a couple of ways. One is to develop and maintain an inventory of complementary paratransit services. A lot of folks are not aware, if I travel to a different community, is there service available? Where is it, and how do I use it? So we'll be expanding that information. We've also developed, though, a key partnership, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a minute, with Senior Navigator, which is a wonderful community portal that provides all types of information for both seniors and the disabled, providing training for staff and then creating an access advisory committee to make sure that the program is meeting the needs of the community. Real quick, Senior Navigator, if you haven't heard about it, is a fantastic resource that we're going to leverage through this program that was established in 2001. Provides online assistance with a network of volunteers, over 21,000 health and agency resources for seniors and caregivers and adults with disabilities. So rather than just talk about paratransit service by itself, we're putting the information where folks that are in need of services in a number of areas can find transportation information. This is a public-private partnership. Again, if you go onto the website, you'll see there is that comprehensive approach to providing information for folks so they don't have to go 8 different places to get the information they need to help these folks out or help themselves out. It is more than just a telephone book. There's a comprehensive display of information, hours of operation, contact information, what the service does, it doesn't do. We'll be enhancing this tremendously through our partnership. And just to wrap it up, these are the partnership goals that we have with Senior Navigator. It's a two-phased approach as to how we roll all of this out, but we should have it basically completed within the next 18 months, and I think it'll be a tremendous benefit to the community. So with that, I'll answer any questions.
Questions from Mr. Hill. This is great work. Thank you very much. This is a small but very important enhancement to statewide transit and human service programs. The next item on the agenda with Mr. Walton here, I'm going to take a little bit of liberty to just run through. If you look on page 2 of the handout, and this is an excellent briefing of major transportation issues. One of the things, Commissioner, I just want to say thank you VDOT covers all transportation issues for all transportation agencies. So we have it in one place. But if you run down on this inside page, reduce the driving fees, we talked about the impact that's now passed out of both the House and the Senate, the access management regulations, where they have accepted the access management regulations on principal arterials, have asked that we go through the Administrative Process Act for minor arterials and collectors. Impact fees is a source of significant efficacy right now. There is legislation that's passed out of the Senate, is now in House rules, that would undo the very significant achievements I think we were able to do in terms of impact fees and integrating transportation land use last session. The incident management bill is moving well through the process, I believe, Mr. Walton. Overweight vehicles, revenue sharing, I know there's a lot of questions about that. Essentially what it does is more heavily weight local management and does away with some of the other requirements in terms of giving higher priority to more fully funded or overmatched projects. And then lastly, tolls on I-81, bill passed out of both houses to require General Assembly approval of any toll on I-81. I would observe that that is a unique condition, and other regions of the Commonwealth, in Hampton Roads, Northern Virginia, and now in other parts of the Commonwealth, looking at a potential tolling solution. In my personal judgment, that legislation, if it stands, does disadvantage the I-81 corridor for attracting both public and private capital. Mr. Walton, did you have anything? I know you're much more detailed and on top of this. Other questions?
I'll be happy to sit down, Mr. Secretary.
Well, no, are there questions of Mr. Walton, not necessarily related to the this market?
Yes. What if anything is the progress of the Nutter bill regarding intermodal rail in Salem, Virginia?
I would ask Mr. Tucker if he may want to respond to that. Intermodal, Delegate Nutter's bill on intermodal facility. I don't believe that survived.
They didn't like my resolution.
Rick, what's your prognosis on 768? Are they going to push it through this, or is it going to be held over till next session?
Well, if you believe the Freelance Star this morning, they quote the speaker, I believe, in saying it's been sent to House Rules. It went to General Laws, and the Speaker is the chair of House Rules. And I think the statement was, and if the local government and the industry can work things out, that we may see something this year. Other than that, it may be studied for a year.
What is it?
The start might be worthwhile. You go ahead and roll.
He's gotten several emails from me on this subject.
That was my question.
Cool. A quick question about Mark Herring's bill, SB 189. It increases the threshold for state and local employees to perform work up to $1 million. I know we have discussed that those thresholds going up in certain areas. Is that normal for the legislature to set those levels, or is it normal for us to set those levels?
No, those the paragraph A of that provision was actually put in the code back in the 70s, and at that time it was $150,000. 82, it went up to $200,000. Or $250,000, 1986 it went up to $300,000, and that's where it's been until this year. Paragraph B with local governments was introduced in the code, I believe, 2 years ago. I will tell you that certain segments of the industry have a little heartburn with this bill, and yesterday when the bill came up in committee, those sentiments were expressed. Afterwards, I sat down with Senator Herring and several members of the industry. I think there's going to be a compromise that will result in lowering, at least from the VDOT perspective, lowering that amount from $1 million, probably something more along the lines of $600,000.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to, in front of the board, commend Mr. Walton. I think I've watched him work before that committee on the most tedious of matters, and you're a tremendously patient person, knowledgeable person, but also the consummate diplomat about what the positions of the department are. So I think you're an artful dodger, my friend. I wonder.
Compliment?
I wonder in general, Do you feel like you've had the type of guidance on these? These are some serious policy questions as well as revenue questions. Is there anything the board can do to help you in that regard? Are we giving you the proper type of guidance that you need, or the proper type of backing that you require?
Ms. Comey, I mean, we work closely with the Secretary's office, and I'm assuming the Secretary on particular issues that need board involvement has an outreach to board members and getting that input, and then in our discussions. We have a weekly meeting with the Secretary's office to go through the docket of what's happened, what's going to be coming up next week. So we have a pretty good team and with a lot of good direction being given. And again, I'll be if there's something you see on this list, and there are a lot of other bills that I didn't include on this list, please feel free to give me a call.
Also, I would reiterate, if you have a relationship with a patron or a key legislator on these issues, please feel free to share that with Mr. Walton, with me, with the commissioner, and Mr. Tucker, those personal relationships and that. So we appreciate it. I was able to help us out on some hard issues. Thank you, Mr. Walton. Okay, if there's no other issues or questions.